The views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores. I am Peddlin' Ron, and you are listening to Bicycle Talk, to be broadcast July 19th, 2023, on WHUS 91.7 FM and WHUS.org. Welcome to Bicycle Talk with my friendly co-host, the lovely Dr. Fran Storch. If you're watching on Facebook Live, you feel free to comment. We should be able to respond. Just comment below. If you're listening in, on an audio file, you can simply send me an email later at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. I'm recording my shows on Monday now using Facebook Live, and then they are playing them at our normal times on Wednesday at 11 a.m. on WHUS 91.7 FM and WHUS.org. You can listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on WHUS.org, iTunes, and Spotify. Okay, here we go. Time to dive into the show. Hey, Ron's rant of the week. Got a few of them here. Of course, we have a few of them. How, and more important, when, to get motorists to ditch the driving habit. The closer you live to work and shopping for food and schools and your general needs is as important as your new car decision. Priorities, people. Yeah, think about that. And cycling socks versus spectator interference. Yeah, I'm going to rant out today about the UCI and their lovely rules and their disregard for rider safety. Anyway, we'll get into that deeper in the show. Of course, this and more in the show. On a positive side, it's Tour de France. Another rest day. Thank goodness. I'm getting really tired watching these guys. This has just been an incredible tour. Are you watching this? Oh my God. It's a two-man race again. Here we go. And shout out to real estate app Zillow. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of Zillow or not, but when I was in the solar business, after the bicycle business, we used Zillow a lot to kind of get a general idea what a house was that we were looking at as far as how we're replacing solar on their roof and all that. So Zillow was kind of a thing that we used. So anyway, Zillow is what I was talking about. Considering a move, check your dream home's bikeability with Zillow. That's why they got a positive side. Zillow actually has a way of rating the home that you're buying or looking at as far as whether they're bikeable or not, or the bikeability that is around that home. So when I talk about things like the closer you live to work for shopping and food and schools and general needs as important as your new car decision, Zillow has already figured that out. Go on to Mechanical Minute and Cycling Tips. And this one falls under body language. Okay, body language. This is something I actually picked up while I was riding in the E-Race this weekend. E-Race is not a race, by the way. It is a cancer ride, fundraising ride. And I had a great experience with Fran this past weekend. She rode like a champion. She was riding really, really well. That was really fun. It's an organized ride. So when you're approaching a rider or a group of riders and you get into a big ride like this, you end up often coming upon a group of riders up in front of you as you're riding along. And so I want to talk a little bit about reading the riders in front of you, because you see a lot of different things when you go to one of these rides. You happen to see people that are, not really riding very straight line. You see people that are weaving back and forth, sort of like when you're driving your car. I hate to say it. But anyway, there's a lot of inconsistency in group rides like this when you're in a big mass start group ride. So you have to kind of read the riders in front of you. What I'm talking about is body language. All right. Body language is like super important to watch. So as you're approaching a group of riders and you see upper body movement that is beyond the normal, let's say there's a lot of, I'm going to demonstrate here because I do have a video feedback here again, I'm going to demonstrate, and you see the upper body movement, you see the swaying back and forth of shoulder to shoulder, you see the shoulders dropping and bobbing and the whole upper body moving back and forth, that is a rider that you have to take with extreme caution. All right, so if you are approaching that rider and you're coming in behind them and you're about to pass them, you really need to make sure that you give them a lot of warning that you're going around them, and you give them a lot of space when you are going around them, because they tend to be, especially when you do the classic on your left, when you mention that on your left, they'll look over at you as you say on your left, they'll turn to the left, and they'll often turn their handlebars also to the left, which will make them weave and sway out towards you. So identifying that body language before you get to that rider is extremely important. I like to mention that. So why do cyclists say on the left? One of the most important things you can do as you're traveling along on a path and or road is to announce your presence with a shout on your left, or passing on your left, or even if you're on a bike path, ringing a bell to alert others or other trail users that you are approaching them and plan to pass. Big proponent of the bell, by the way, on the bike paths, because a lot of times, especially people who are pedestrians on those paths or hiking on those paths, they just don't know you're coming up because you're on a bicycle and you're pretty quiet, and so therefore they can't hear you. But if you give them the ring-a-ding a long way before, not when you're right on top of them, but a long way before, it's a very, very polite way of approaching another person who is using the trail. We are all human. We are all out there to use the trail together. So that's my my tip of the week is body language, and make sure you say on your left when you're passing on the left. It is not rude. It is actually a really nice thing to do. I used to do it years and years and years ago when I was alpine skiing, downhill skiing. You came up on another skier, you told them, I'm on your left or I'm on your right, and then they knew to basically hold their position, or as we like to say in the bike riding world, hold your line, and then you could go by them safely, and that was a good thing. That's exactly what you want to do. So anyway, oh, look, it's Patrick. Patrick calling, and Don is also watching here this morning. Really, really nice to see you guys here. Let's get into the content of the show. People that were watching this are just going to have to deal with the audio file this week because something is seriously, seriously wrong here. Let's start with the UCI. All right. This UCI is the governing organization of international cycling. And to start, we'll talk about the official and unofficial and thus written rules of wearing cycling socks. Why am I starting here? I'll explain this in just a minute. It's kind of crazy as to what's going on here, but they're drawn up by the UCI, the world governing body of sports cycling. The last version of the technical regulation was released in May of 2020, states that socks used in competition may not rise above the height defined by half the distance between the middle of the lateral malleolus and middle of the fibula head. In other words, a sock can't be higher than halfway up your lower leg. The precise measurement can be seen in a picture, which I will probably post up on Facebook so you can check that out. But so the big question is, why can't the socks be higher? Why can't the socks be lower? We don't know. It's because the UCI is stupid. Excuse me, but they are. And everybody, they really want everybody to look very, very uniform and to look professional. So that's why they have this sock rule. So why do I bring this up again, you ask? Again, yeah, I've done this before.
Can I ask you something about the socks?
You can ask all about the socks. We are not on video any longer, by the way.
Okay.
We have lost that. So anyway, phooey, we're just on audio. Ask away, Fran. What do you got?
So the sock, could the sock thing be a safety thing? Because if your socks are a little bit higher, aren't you going to be less likely to get, you know, nicks from like bugs and rocks and dirt and stuff?
That's a real stretch. No.
So to speak. If your socks are stretchier.
If your socks are stretchier. That's right. That's a real stretch. No, it has absolutely nothing to do with anything safety-wise. It has all to do with uniform.
It's interesting because when I got my last Gulf Coast Velo kit, So I belong to a club down in Florida.
Right.
And when I got my last kit, I ordered the socks too. I got two pair that went with my kit, and they were white with red designs and red with white designs. And they were long. They were, you know, halfway up my leg. They look cool. They don't feel cool this time of year.
No.
And they wear them in Florida. But maybe they did that because people are racing.
Yeah, well, you know, there's that. And then it's the, you know, want to look cool factor, too. So, you know, I mean, you know,
because you can see
We're very style oriented here in this world of cycling. So
on Zwift, anyway, you can design your own sock. I mean, they have you different choices of socks, but you can design the heights how you like.
It's not even real, though. Anyway,
it's so fun.
So anyway, the sock thing. So why am I all about this sock thing? Because the UCI, in their diligence to make sure that you have the right socks on, do not spend a lot of time taking care of the riders who are racing in these big races. So I have a defense here for the UCI, but I also have an offense on it too. So why I bring it up is because they seem to be more focused on sock height than they are about barriers between riders and spectators, and less concerned about the socks. This, of course, is in reference to the takedown of Sepp Kuss in the last stage of the Tour de France. One of many. And if I have time later in the show, I'll explain some of the other incidents that have happened this year. Enough to make the major presses of the world pay attention to it. So in defense of the UCI, because I got to defend them, I got to give both sides of the story. That's the way this works. All right. There was a hard press, a very hard attack that Pogacar made against Vingegaard. And when he attacked, the motorbikes in front of him had come to a quick stop, and he had to back off on his attack because he was about to crash into the back of the motorbikes. It kind of ruined his move, so to speak, and then they were back together again. So 2 kilometers further up, Vingegaard was back, and Pogacar tried to launch a fierce sprint for bonus seconds at the summit. He was unable to get past a photographer's motorcycle riding alongside of a television motorcycle. He says, quote unquote, "I lost a bullet, but that's what it is," said Pogacar. "I was blocked by a motorbike, which was also blocked." All right, these things happen. It's the Tour de France. The motorcycle was itself hemmed in by a crowd closing in on the road. "I told my driver to accelerate when Pogacar attacked, but he could not, as there were fans in front," the photographer told Reuters. "We should have gone away before and forgotten about the picture." Yeah, that would have been a wise move. It would have also got you, kept you from being excluded from Sunday's 15th stage. Officials excluded both the motorbikes from the stage. "Those motorbikes should not be there, but I appreciate that everyone is trying to do their job here," Pogacar's UAE Emirates team manager Mauro Giannotti told reporters, while the team sports director Maxine Fernandez called the incident unacceptable. All right, so more Tour de France later in the show. But first, from the other item on the rant today, let's go back to, I said something about, you know, motorists ditching the driving habit and priorities and all that fun stuff. So I got a few things to play around with here. And we will get back, I promise, we will go back to the Tour de France. It's a big deal right now. So anyway, I found this great feed that came through, and it was called Bike Lash. You know what Bike Lash is, Fran?
They're very trendy eyelashes that you can wear while you're riding your bike.
Probably not.
Like the ones that the basketball players wear.
It's probably not. But nice attempt.
Hi, okay. Susan.
All right. So Bike Lash is real. Okay. A couple of weeks ago, a video was shared on social media of a driver threatening and verbally assaulting a cyclist in Toronto, Canada. The person on the bicycle handled it very well, not being aggressive, but speaking confidently and filming everything. There was no physical assault, but it's an incident. So, how to deal with Bike Lash? This comes from a great site, which I just stumbled across because someone put this on my Facebook
feed. I get it. Bike lash instead of backlash.
Yes, it's bike lash instead of backlash. You absolutely have it. So this is a site called momentummag.com. All right, and they're out of Toronto, Canada. They are a bicycle site. I thought they had a very interesting thing to talk about here, so I'm going to read some of this to you because I like this. So bike lash is real. All right, bike lash, or the negative backlash against bicyclists and the bicycling infrastructure, can be frustrating and discouraging an experience for those who love to bike. However, there are ways to handle it and advocate for safer and more accessible biking options. There are some helpful strategies here. So there are some drivers out there that just do not like people on bicycles, and they feel they have no right to any space on the road or in a bike lane or anywhere else. We got to get out of the road while we were on the e-race last
week. A really angry person in a pickup truck.
Of course it was a pickup truck. Why would it not be a pickup truck? Well, because the pickup trucks, or an SUV or whatever. And we had another experience where we had a green light. There were probably close to a dozen of us that had the green light. We were waiting for it to turn. It turned.
We were turning
onto a busy road, making a left-hand turn onto a busy road. We were in the proper lane. We were doing everything correctly. And across the street, at the other side of that traffic light, a woman in a large SUV decided that she was going to just go out into the road. And I, used my booming Italian voice. And she's making a right on red when she shouldn't, because there was a green light from the other direction, and it wasn't really her place to do that.
Stop, then yield.
I understand that, Fran. And so anyway, she made that turn, all right, in front of a dozen cyclists. And I was the first one there, so I just yelled out at the top of my lungs as loud as I could, "Stop! No!" And she hit the brakes, screeched to a halt, and I think I scared the daylights out of her, quite honestly. She just looked at me with this panicked look, and then all of us just rode by her and went down the road like we were supposed to. Once again, the same old question comes out. Same question every single time. If we were a car, would she have done that? The answer is no, she would not. Rarely would she have done that. So anyway, we get past her and we go down the road, and I know I scared her because when she did decide to finally pass us, she was on the other side of the road. She was actually over the yellow line on the other side of the road. So I know I scared the daylights out of her. So don't be afraid to use your personal horn, otherwise known as your loud voice, when necessary in a situation like that. So anyway, here we go. Back to understanding the root causes of bike lash, or the backlash of cycling. To understand the phenomenon of bike lash, it's important to examine the historical context of bicycles and their impact on society. Bicycles have been around for centuries, evolving from simple wooden contraptions to sleek and efficient machines we know today. Throughout history, bicycles have played a significant role in transportation, recreation, and even social movements. However, their presence has not always been welcomed with open arms. From the early days of bicycles being seen as a threat to horse-drawn carriages, yep, it's for real, to the more recent debates about bike lanes and urban planning, bicycles have often been met with resistance and animosity. By exploring the historical context, we can gain insights into the deep-rooted factors that contribute to bike lash and better understand why some people harbor such strong negative feelings towards bicyclists. It is relatively recent and an emerging area of study. And its presence has become increasingly noticed in cities. Changing roads to include space for cyclists. Bike lanes have become a community-wide impact and challenge existing hierarchies and patterns of movement, which can make them vulnerable to community opposition and antipathy. According to Kit Keller of the Association for Pedestrian and Bicycle Professionals, bike lash signals that we're moving through three stages of social change, in which a new idea or concept is, first stage, ridiculed, second stage, violently opposed, and third stage, gradually accepted. Perception of inconvenience and disruption caused by bicycles. One reason why some people develop a dislike towards bicycles is the perception of inconvenience and disruption caused by them. Some individuals may view bicycles as a hindrance to traffic flow, especially in congested urban areas. They may feel that cyclists take up a valuable road space, slow down the overall movement of vehicles. Additionally, the presence of bike lanes or designated cycling areas may require adjustments to existing infrastructure, such as reducing the number of parking spaces or altering road layouts. These changes can be seen as inconvenient by some individuals, leading to a negative perception of bicycles and contributing to bike lash. It's important for cities and communities to carefully plan and communicate the benefits of cycling infrastructure to address these concerns and promote a more positive attitude towards bicycles. Remember last week's episode where I talked about the amount of time that people, or maybe it was 2 weeks ago, can't remember. I talked about the amount of time people spend in a McDonald's drive-thru versus the amount of time it takes to get around a cyclist down the road safely. Anyway, my point. So one of the best ways to combat bike lash is to educate yourself and others about the many benefits of cycling. This can include improved physical health, reduced traffic congestion, and smaller carbon footprint. Share articles, studies, and personal stories that highlight these benefits with friends, family, and colleagues. You can also get involved in your local cycling advocacy groups to help spread the word and promote cycling as a viable mode of transportation. By educating others, you can help change negative attitudes towards cycling and create a more bike-friendly community. Like Bicycle Talk here on Facebook Live. That apparently is live once again. I keep going back and forth here. I'm having some connection issues this morning. Advocate for better infrastructure and policies. Yeah, you know, I talk about it every week. I talk about it at the end of my show every week. You got to get out. You got to get active. You got to go show up to your town meetings. You got to become part of the solution and not part of the problem. So anyway, it's important. No one will know unless you tell them. No one will understand unless you have a respectful conversation with them. And that brings me to this: stay calm and respectful in confrontations. When faced with bike lash, it's important to remain calm in confrontations. Avoid getting defensive and confrontational, as this can escalate the situation and make it more difficult to find a resolution. Instead, try to listen to the other person's argument and concerns and try to respond in a calm and rational manner. Remember that you are an ambassador for cycling and your behavior can impact how others perceive cyclists as a whole. By staying calm, you can help diffuse tense situations and promote a positive image of cycling. I talk about this all the time. First thing I will do if I can get someone to pull over and talk to me about it, or if I get a chance to have that conversation, is I thank them very much for stopping and talking to me about the situation. Simple. That's the biggest diffuser you can do, is to look at them. They're looking at you like they're angry at you. They're looking at you like you're angry at them. Right? Because you obviously had some sort of an incident that got you to this situation. And when you come across as, thanks so much for helping out and pulling over and talking to me about this, they don't know what to do. It's great. It works great every time. So anyway, that's a beautiful thing. Dealing with bike lash can be isolating and frustrating, but you don't have to go through it alone. Connect with other cyclists and advocacy groups. That's a really good thing. And then ultimately, overcoming bike lash requires a comprehensive approach that combines effective communication, community engagement, and a commitment to designing infrastructure that's safe, inclusive, and context sensitive. By working together, cities can create environments where cycling is embraced as a variable and attractive mode of transportation, fostering healthier, more sustainable, and connecting communities for everyone. Another point that I bring up when I talk to people about people on bikes and people using their bikes for transportation is it's one less car on the road that they get stuck behind in traffic. It's one less car that they have to wait for that light to change up ahead so they can get through on their way to their busy schedule or their McDonald's drive-thru or whatever it is that they're trying to get to. More bikes, less cars, less congestion, everybody moves freer. It all works. I know I'm an optimist on this, but I think you kind of have to be, because we've got some really strange behavior out there these days, and I'm a little concerned about it. So anyway, so bike lash, it's real. It's a real thing. But you know what? I think it's time for us to move on. We've got to cover the Tour de France here. It's bike racing news. I'll go back. I promise I'll go back. But there's so much good Tour de France right now. It is unbelievable. It's a 10-second race, folks. 10 seconds. It was 9 seconds before yesterday, and then it was 10 seconds yesterday. We're talking... one of the closest Tour de France's since Greg LeMond beat Bernard Hinault at 8 seconds a number of years ago. And how did he do it? Well, there was this time trial. And what's coming up tomorrow after the rest day? Well, there's this time trial. Now, everything I've read, everything I've studied on this, it appears that Pogačar and Vingegaard are both very, very similar as far as the time trial goes. And yes, a race can be won or lost with the time trial, but next week is, I'm going to get to that, next week is ugly, or starting Wednesday, it gets real, real ugly. Seeing as both riders will probably get through the time trial and probably be number one and number two in some way finishing that time trial, I don't think there's going to be a big split in time as far as that goes. So they may remain at the same 10 seconds. There may be a couple seconds lost. There may be a couple of seconds gained. I don't think we're going to see a whole lot. Fignon. Oh, yeah, it was Fignon, wasn't it? Yeah, you're right. Absolutely, Pete. Thank you. Just unbelievable what can happen from this point on. We got a lot of action ahead. The time trial tomorrow is only 22 kilometers, so it's really short. It's not a lot of time to win or lose in 22 kilometers. They all go really fast at this point. They're all going, to put it into miles per hour, they're all going over 30 miles per hour when they're doing these time trials. So they're flying. And you got two of the top athletes in the world out here going against one another. I don't expect to see a big change. So right now what we have is we got Jonas Vingegaard, and he is in first place at 62 hours, 34 minutes, and 17 seconds. Right behind him is Tadej Pogačar, and Tadej is 10 seconds behind him. In third place, coming from way behind and all of a sudden up there he is Carlos Rodriguez Cano, and for the Ineos Grenadiers, and he is 5 minutes and 21 seconds behind. That's a big gap. It's a two-man race right now. It's going to be hard to believe that it could be anything but that. A horrible crash would do that. That could make a change, but I just don't see it. Between third and fourth place, we've got Adam Yates at 5 minutes and 40 seconds. So we're talking about a 21-second difference right there. And Jai Hindley from Bora is in fifth place, 6 minutes and 38 seconds behind. Remember, he was way up there in the front there for a while. So, but I think the more remarkable one, and again, it's a big time gap, but in sixth place overall, it's Sepp Kuss. And Sepp Kuss is the guy who got taken down by the spectator on the side of the road with the camera, and then got back up to go back up and help his yellow jersey, continue to defend that yellow jersey. Sepp Kuss wins the That Guy award for me. That guy, the guy that was able to do something almost superhuman. Crash your bike, get back on your bike, you're bleeding. They patched him while he was riding along. He was still bleeding profusely from his elbow, and he was back in the main pack again, back helping the yellow jersey. I give Sepp a big shout out for that. That's really cool. He's also our first American rider in the tour this year, so he's doing really well. After that, we've got Pello Biabo Lopez, and he is just a minute behind Sepp Kuss. Simon Yates is in about the same position, a little over a minute. And David Gadeau, who was from Groupama, he'll be, I guess he's probably our first French rider. And he is 14 minutes behind. And Guillaume Martin is 14-18 behind. Those are your top 10. There have been 19 withdrawals in this year's tour so far. Two members of the Jumbo-Visma and two members of the UAE Team Emirates remain in the top 10. So that's important to know, because that means they're strong enough to be up there. That means they're strong enough to be helping out both the two top riders in the later stages of this race. Speaking of which, upcoming stages. All right, the 22-kilometer time trial, generally pretty flat. And it's only 22 kilometers, not that big a deal. But let me tell you, there is some stuff happening. And it is, when we get to Wednesday, all right, we're going to see just an incredible ouch day is what I call it. There's I see two category one climbs, I see one category two climb, and a beyond category climb bringing it all the way up to the finish. It's 165.7 kilometers. It just looks like not anything that I would want to be involved with. It's very, very long, and it's got big mountains in it. So that is going to be one of the two deciding points. But the very end of that race, I highlighted it, and I've got it up here in front of me. You can go to the Tour de France site, and you can pull all this information down. But the final climb is where are we at here? It's really, really long. It's like 27 kilometers or something like that, and it has a piece on the top of the Col de la Lose, and it is over 10% in grade. It is beyond category. The whole climb is listed as beyond category. There's a screaming downhill on the opposite side of it with a short pop, which they will just roll over. And then another equally difficult, super steep finishing line. And that finishing line, it's not very long. It's not very long. It's only about a kilometer long. But as we have seen in the past, Tadej Pogačar loves that steep stuff. He is really good at it. And Jonas has been real good about hanging on to him and riding. I call him the diesel engine, because he just doesn't change pace. Tadej will have one of these really hard jumps, and Jonas will just sit tight and very predictable and eventually reel him back in. And whether they figured this out, whether they you know, sat down and studied this and realized, you know, about how far out Pogačar can go and then get reeled back in or not, I'm sure it's been studied all over the place. But that has been the history so far. So they're true competitors with one another. The last stage they raced, there was an attempt for Pogačar to get away and get some time. He didn't do it. Jonas came around him at the end. They went across the finish line together. There were no points for finishing because those points were taken up the road. Brilliant move, by the way, by Jumbo to send their rider out to try to Wout Van Aert to go out and try to win the stage, because they took away all the finishing points by doing that. So, and then the Yates, Simon Yates did the same. Adam Yates did the same thing, and he went really hard for UAE, but then he got reeled back in. Point is, the first three riders that crossed were not the two top riders in the tour, so there are no extra points to be made there, which is a really smart tactical move by the other teams. But anyway, that's what it was. They know it's going to be, you know, that tight, so they're doing everything they can to make it happen that way. If it comes down to these two guys getting away by themselves up in the front, then there's big points to be earned for first place and second place. So it changes the times by doing that. So that's kind of important. So then we've got some flat stages floating around in between all that. And then we've got Saturday. And Saturday is being listed as the Queen Stage. And it is again riddled with nasty stuff. We've got three category two climbs, one category three climb, two category one climbs, and then our finish line is at the top of that category one climb, which is 7.1 kilometers at 8.4% on the average. And I've also got a highlight on that. And on that, there are, on that last 7 kilometers, there are not one, not two, not three, but four over 10% climbs that are segments that are going to be on that climb. Lights, camera, action. We got a show. We got a big time show. So anything can happen. So all I can say is ouch. At the end of the day, Pogacar is still breathing down Vingegaard's back, his neck, and he is convinced that the tour will be decided by a small margin. That's what Tadej Pogacar said. It'll be a matter of seconds in the coming days, he said. We'll fight until the end, the 24-year-old rider said. Jonas Vingegaard believes otherwise. I don't think it will be decided by seconds. At one point, someone will take a fair bit of time on the other, he said. Comments? Predictions? Anybody? Anybody got that? What do you think? You think about that. I think it's more like seconds. I don't know. That I, you know, when you think about it, time trial is going to come dead even. That's not going to be a big deal. That stage on Wednesday, somebody's going to do something there. If the teams are strong enough to be able to hold everything together and keep it from happening, I will be super surprised. If someone does go on that stage, then Saturday's stage becomes the deciding moment. And then, again, anything can happen. This is a great tour. If you're into bike racing, even if you're not into bike racing, you need to pay attention to this. This is pretty cool stuff. There's a lot of excitement going on here. It really is a fun Tour de France this year. I'm just loving it. This is my element. I do like this. And I have to say, again, and I said this last year, I always used to like the Giro better than I like the Tour as my favorite race. And the Tour de France the last 2 years has been very, very interesting and really has me consumed. So that's really cool. Speaking of consumed, if you have not seen Unchained on Netflix, what are you waiting for? Borrow a friend's. Go over to a friend's house and watch it. Whatever you need to do. Maybe pay for Netflix for a week or so, and watch all 8 episodes. It's just unbelievable. It's so exciting, so cool. Definitely a must-see if you're at all into riding your bicycle and looking at how difficult it is to be a Grand Tour rider. It's just fabulous. So I can go back now from earlier and I can talk about So the UCI and how they're being more focused, maybe they should be more focused on barriers between the riders and spectators and less concerned about Sox. This, of course, in reference to the takedown of Sepp Kuss, which I said earlier in the show. I pulled this one off of Forbes, so it made international media. We'll call Forbes international media. Tour de France fans caused multiple crashes leading to rider injuries and withdrawal from race. How about that? So, it made it all the way to Forbes, which is really interesting. Distracted fans caused multiple crashes along the Tour de France route over the weekend, leading to injuries, lost time by riders, even withdrawal of one rider from the entire race, as fan interactions continue to be a point of frustration for the cyclists. They called it bikers. It's Forbes. We'll give them a credit there. Stef Kras, a cyclist from Belgium who was in 13th position at the time of his crash, had serious bruising on his hip and elbow that led him to having to leave the race after the first week after a fan wasn't paying attention to the race and got in the way of the cyclists, according to Velo, a cycling media outlet owned by Outside Magazine. Kras' collision also slowed the 4th and 11th place riders, British cyclist Simon Yates and Spanish cyclist Mikel Landa, who both lost 47 seconds in the race as a result. Yates and Kras were both podium contenders in this year's race ahead of the collision. A second fan-induced incident, a French cyclist, Lilian Calmejean, crashed when a fan waved a tribute pole with jerseys hung on it onto the course. Oh, that was just ugly. It was like they had a clothesline and there were a bunch of jerseys that were on the clothesline. They were waving it back and forth on this big, huge stick. And of course, it caught onto one of the cyclist's handlebars and kaboom, down they went. Calmejean was able to catch back up and his team tweeted that he'll continue the race, but he asked fans to be careful when the peloton comes by. Yeah, no kidding. So, but yet, there's more. So crashes caused by fans aren't uncommon in the Tour de France. Organizers of the Tour released a video ahead of this year's race asking fans to respect riders' efforts by protecting their children at the race and not running along with the bikers, all of which caused catastrophic crashes for competitors. In 2021, a fan holding a banner standing on the edge of the road with her back turned on the nearing group of riders caused a crash involving almost the entirety of the peloton and some fans. A woman was later fined about $1,300 and suffered online abuse after the two riders had to leave the race and the eight were injured as a result of the incident. When a spectator steps up more than 1 meter up the road and they don't move when the peloton arrives, you better stay home. You have no respect for the riders. And it's really, and Kras tweeted that after his incident. It's just sad, it's a great race. And the cool thing about the bike race and about all these Grand Tour races is it's one thing. It's the one spectator-free race, free meaning no money involved, sporting event that you can go to, which is why it is the most watched event in the world. You just line yourself up on the side of the road, your picnic lunch, have a couple of drinks and yell and scream when they go by, and they go on by in a flash and they're done.
Yeah.
And that's it. And that's what you see. But to get overly enthusiastic and make a clothesline full of cycling jerseys that gets hooked on a rider's handlebars, not good. Not good at all. To be so close to the edge of the road that your the strap of your purse gets out and hooks the handlebar of a bike and takes down, infamous Lance Armstrong years ago went down on a crash like that. We're talking about the best athletes in the world that are having major problems with this. And it's also, like it was said earlier, it made a difference in a couple of the Grand Tour riders because they all of a sudden got pushed back by almost a minute in time because of bad crashes in front of them that were created by spectators. this isn't good. This is something that we really need to start paying a lot more attention to. It's a little on the sad side, and you know, I love bike racing and I love everything about it and how it all works, but there has to be a little more respect for the cyclists that are out there. That's all I can say. So anyway, that's it. And then we're going to go way, way back. I had things I had talked about earlier, and I still have plenty of time here to do this. So how to get motorists to ditch their driving habit. This is not going to happen easily. So we talk about this a lot. We talk a lot about this a lot on the show. And, you know, we live in a country that is very car-centric. And because it's car-centric, people will get in their car and drive 2 miles down the road to go to the grocery store. They will drive 5 miles down the road to get to work and back. They just aren't, we just don't think transportation the way other parts of the world think transportation. Because of that, what we end up with is traffic and congestion. Lots of it. Okay? So some transit agencies are sending free bus tickets to new residents, but by then it may have already been too late to try an alternative to driving. And to me, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. I rode my bike this morning up to the community center. I taught my spin class. I rode my bike back home. The car stayed still. I am going to be teaching yet another class this evening, and I'm planning on riding my bike in, teaching a class, and riding back home. Therefore, keeping my vehicle parked in the garage. That's my perfect world if I can do it. It doesn't always work out that way. You know, yesterday I had to run out to the grocery store and it was pouring out. And you know what? I'm a little soft when it comes to riding in the rain. I didn't really want to put rain gear on and ride my bike there. Plus the fact that the danger factor is really, really high because people aren't used to seeing people on the road on bicycles in a rainstorm, especially around here. So I did use my car to do that. But the key to getting drivers to try other modes isn't just convincing them that taking the bus is a better option. It's prompting them to explore their travel options months before a major life change shakes up their ingrained travel routines. A new study suggests experts in mobility psychology have long maintained that our travel habits are so deeply ingrained that only major transitions in our lives encourage us to change the way we get around, which helps explain the whole COVID thing and how that changed a lot of people's ideas and attitudes. It also explains why Americans don't always drive less when gas prices soar or a great new bus rapid transit line gets installed just a block away from their house. So it's just going to take a while to reset the brain. Generally speaking, in the U.S., what usually resets our brains is money. And if it becomes really, really, really expensive to drive a vehicle, a motorized vehicle, then maybe that would be a factor. Although there seems to be a ceiling point on that too. And once it really has to go extremely high before people will park their car because of money. What people will park their car for, and what I find they feel more offensive than anything else, is not the price of gas, but the tax that's on the gas and the tax that they have to pay or seemingly have to pay to be able to drive their cars. That seems to be a factor, and that seems to help a lot. I've watched a number of families go from two-car families down to one-car families by doing that, and then they trade off with riding bikes and or taking a bus or whatever it is, and trying to allocate their time a little bit better. So respondents who had moved to new homes or gotten new jobs start contemplating how they get there on the average of 2 months before they actually made the switch, poring over routes and schedules and calculating transfer costs. Even if they belong to low-income households, no choice but to take transit. So Where you live is part of how it all works. Living close to where you work is a luxury, and it's kind of nice to have, but it's not a luxury that's uncommon here in the United States. 5 to 10 miles maximum is what we have. If you had a safe way to get there, you would probably do it. So this is a consideration that you have to look at. So I'm not telling you to sell your house or move from your apartment to another one, but maybe the next time you are looking at that, you need to look at the idea of transportation and how you're going to function in your society when you're moving to this new home. And yes, it is a nice shirt, Kim. Very nice. I have my E-Race shirt on. Kim is actively involved in the E-Race ride that we did this past weekend. So anyway, how do we get people to ditch the driving habit? I'm not sure. I say keep talking about it. I say get out and talk to your public officials about it. I say provide more safe places to ride the bike. I think those are all factors which help. But the big one that I say, and this one comes all the way back from my days in the bicycle industry, the only way to get more people on bicycles is to put more people on bicycles. More butts on bikes is what we used to call it back in the day. Because the visual of that, when you're driving a motorized vehicle down the road and you pass one or two cyclists when you're going to work, you go, okay, I passed a couple of cyclists. No big deal. They were probably in my way. I was probably angry about it, right? Because that's kind of the general attitude. But when you're driving to work at that same time, as you have every day, and now you're passing 10 or 12 cyclists while you're going to work, you get this aha moment. And maybe it'll tell you that it's time for you to reconsider that, or maybe it will give a visual that I have to slow down now. I have to watch out for the cyclists because there's a lot more cyclists on the road. What a good idea. Maybe I should try that. Just a point. So that's kind of how I feel about that. And then this is the last little piece here before we wrap it up here for today. But considering a move, check your dream home's bikeability with Zillow. Zillow, all right, popular real estate app, is responding to the bike boom in the U.S., which was kind of really COVID-ish time, but they now added a bike score in addition to its walk score and its transit score. So when you look at a house on Zillow, it'll give you both transit score, so you know how close are you to a bus stop, which will carry you into the major city that you're living near or in within the major city you're living in, but also how close things are to walk to. And now there's also a pedal to work from your dream house. So they licensed the bike store technology from WalkScore, which also uses on the site, and to increase the interest in cycling over the last few years. So if Zillow sees the interest in cycling and they're seeing this uptick on, you know, bike lanes and other things going on, this is a good sign. This is a really, really, really good thing. Buying a house, by the way, it's positioned near a bike path. Wow, what a unique idea. I have a friend who's been involved with the East Coast Greenway Trail for years. He's a real estate agent. And he started selling houses based on how close they were to bike paths. And he has a reputation for, he's the guy you go to if you want to find a house that is going to be close to the bike trail. Pretty smart for sure. So now it's becoming a marketable asset. So destinations and connectivity is measured by using a modified version of Zillow's walk score, allowing for a bit more distance between destinations since you will be pedaling and not walking. The bicycle mode share was also included, just to add if an area has bike share, but to also confirm that an area has a high cyclist population. Researchers quickly realized that bike share wasn't the only indicator of a strong commuter community since some areas don't have much bike infrastructure, but still have huge cycling populations. They cited Portland, Oregon as an example. There you go. So anyway, it's great. There you have it. It's Zillow. They're a real estate app. What are they paying attention to? Cycling. That's a good thing. This is all a good thing. So that's going to bring me towards the conclusion of our show, and we are going to go to events. And this weekend we have coming up, and Fran has left the building, we have coming up the Quiet Corner Bike Tour presented by our local club, the Thread City Cyclers. It is Sunday, July 23rd. It is on Bike Reg. If you would like to sign up for it, we've got some great rides for you. We've got a 25-mile ride. We've got a 42-mile ride. We've got 43-mile ride. We've got a 69-mile ride and a 100-mile ride. So bring your climbing legs. We are not flat out here.
Did you see the 18?
We also have an 18-mile gravel ride, too, for those of you who are into the whole gravel scene right now. These are all coming up. Quiet Corner Bike Tour. They will be on Sunday, July 23rd, 2023 in Chaplin, Connecticut. And you can find all the information on either the threadcitycyclers.com or also on Bike Reg. Also, the bicycle game is still on early history of bicycles in Hartford at the State Historical Society. That is the 110th edition of the Tour de France is expected to finish in Paris next weekend, next Sunday. Yeah, here we go. Drinking champagne on Sunday. There we are. The 78th edition of the Vuelta a España takes place in Barcelona, August 26th. Made, M-A-D-E, that's www.made.bike, a new industry and consumer bike highlighting the craft of hand-built bicycles, begins on August 24th to the 27th in the Rose Quarter in Portland, Oregon. And in...
that's by Burnside.
That's nice.
Downtown.
On August 19th, it's the 32nd annual Steeplechase Bike Tour. We will be talking a lot more about that in the future because I am on the board of directors for that ride. So anyway, finishing points. So what do you think, UCI? How do you feel about the UCI? I just, you know, they need to get their act together. They need to get their priorities straight, right? That's what they need to do. And, you know, that's something that's going to take some time. I don't know if we're going to get them to change overnight. You never know. But anyway... How about some more barriers in the heavy crowded areas, folks? That's all we're asking for. Stop taking down the best athletes in the world. You know, it seems crazy. All right, don't forget about the bicycle game. Once again, I'll say it again. It won't be my last time. Get loud, get active. Our time has come. Stop complaining about traffic, dangerous roads, the price of gas, the lack of places to safely ride your bike, and join the revolution to change. And pick up your bike one day a week and just use that to travel around. You might just surprise yourself. The views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. You've been listening to Bicycle Talk with my co-host, Fran Storch. It's a show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle advocacy, bicycle culture, the upcoming news in cycling, bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. If you've been listening to this on Facebook Live, I apologize for the interruptions this morning. We're having some sort of an internet issue here. This is Pedlin' Ron. Remember, keep that rubber side down and the wind at your back. Get out and ride your bike. It really could save your life. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org. Thank you all for listening. See you next week.